Welcome to Bergenomics, demystifying economics with Ross McDowell.
Blockchain, cryptocurrency, and distributed ledger. We hear these phrases more and more, but good luck when asking anyone for an explanation. Like most new concepts, blockchain and crypto make us uneasy. And that's because we don't understand them. The same sort of fear many people had all those years ago when the internet started. To demystify blockchain, cryptocurrency, and the distributed ledger, the Bergenomics podcast is lucky to have Australia's number one blockchain expert, distinguished Professor Jason Potts. Distinguished Professor Potts's blockchain credentials are extraordinary. Jason is co-director of the Blockchain Innovation Hub at RMIT. He is also a chief investigator on the ARC Center of Excellence for Automated Decision-Making and Society. He has written 5 books and published over 80 articles on topics including crypto economies and blockchain. Jason is an editor of the Journal of Institutional Economics, vice president of the International Joseph Schumpeter Society, a board member of Australian Digital Commerce Association, and a fellow of the British Blockchain Association. He is also a member of the steering committee of the Australian Government's National Blockchain Roadmap. Professor Jason Potts, welcome to the Bergenomics podcast.
Russ, it's fantastic to be here.
Now, before I get you to demystify distributed ledgers, blockchain, and cryptocurrencies, I just want to read you a few quotes. "It's all beyond me, but it's something I realize I will have to know about at some point. It doesn't relate to my business. I skip over articles about it as I don't understand it. You need a level of confidence as it involves your savings and your business cash flow. I'm not sure if I'll ever have that level of confidence." And the last quote, "I don't trust it because I haven't grown up with it." Are these the quotes that you would normally expect of anybody encountering any form of new technology, and so they're very reticent to want to talk about it, accept it, or think that they're going to be forced to have to use it?
Yeah, look, this is what we see with all new technologies. And this is, I'm an economist. I work at a university, run a research lab that specializes in blockchain, the technology. But the reason I got interested in this was really wanting to understand this new type of innovation, a new innovation that just looked strange to me when I first saw it. It was coming, it was a money, it was computer science, it was cryptography, it was just all of this weird combination of things coming together. And what fascinated me about it as a new innovation or as a new technology was just how fast it was moving. It was just one of these things that just, it wasn't there, and then suddenly it was there, then suddenly it seemed to be everywhere. And this notion of new technologies come along all the time. They always seem a bit surprising and scary at first because they're unfamiliar. Then we sort of figure out and start to use them and become familiar with them and then see the value in them. And eventually that process, and then they embed themselves in the economy. Normally that process takes decades. With cryptocurrencies and with blockchain technology, this was faster than mobile phones. This was faster than computers in the sense that those technologies, which we, most of us are relatively unskeptical about computers and the internet and mobile phones now, but there was a time when they were weird and scary and new. And we sort of, a lot of people were just hoping they would go away. Same thing with blockchain technology. It's a new type of technology that's come along, entered the world in 2009. So, 13 years ago, not that long ago. But this is like the internet in the early 1990s, or like computers in the 1980s, or like mobile phones in the 2000s, maybe. There's some early adopters that have come into it soon. Often these are relatively young people that didn't have much to lose by experimenting with this new technology. But all new technologies take time. It often takes time not just to familiarize ourselves with what they are and how they work, but far more importantly, to see the value proposition in it. Why is this of value to me? How can I make this part of my life? So, I've become fascinated with this just because it was such a fast-moving technology. We'd never seen anything just go through this early stage adoption process so fast. So there was obviously something interesting there. Myself and my research team, we dug into this.
Okay. So now it's the terms that baffle. That's what I call them. If we can go through blockchain, distributed ledger, decentralized autonomous organizations, non-fungible tokens, and provide an ultra-intuitive explanation for each, currently implemented examples for each, and maybe future applications for each. You're going to have to put up with me because I'm going to jump in all the time with some probably very basic questions. So please have patience with me. Let's start off with blockchain.
All right. That's the perfect place to start, Ross. So blockchain technology is the technology that is behind everything. That was the innovation that didn't exist in the world before. Blockchain technology is the way in which we provide security for everything that this tech does. So cryptocurrencies such as Bitcoin are an application or a use of blockchain technology. That's one of the things we can do with it. Now, when Satoshi Nakamoto, who we still don't know who that person or maybe group of people are, invented Bitcoin back in 2008/2009, it went live on January the 3rd, 2009. That was Bitcoin. And in order to invent Bitcoin, which is a cryptocurrency, the world's first cryptocurrency, Satoshi Nakamoto had to invent blockchain technology to make it work. And all of the initial excitement was around Bitcoin, the world's first cryptocurrency. But now we've sort of shifted towards understanding that the real innovation there was actually blockchain technology. So let me try and break this down a bit, because I just want to make that distinction. Blockchain technology is the thing we want to talk about here today. Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies are a use case, the first one, okay. But we can use it for all sorts of other things. Okay. It's the same way think of it like the internet can be used for email. But you can also use the internet for other things. Bitcoin is email in that story, and blockchain is the internet. The starting point for this, I think, is the problem of what blockchain technology does is it enables us to create something that we've never had in the world before, which was digital scarcity, to have something made completely digital. So it's made of software and it exists in computers on the internet, but is scarce. In the same way that gold is scarce in the physical in the world. The thing about the internet and digital objects is that they're not scarce. I can copy them, I can paste them, we can make millions of copies of it, we can just keep doing that. If I have a digital object, the basic problem was, and the huge benefit of what the internet and computers gave us, was we could communicate for free with anyone. Digital communication was just costless. It was a phenomenal tool. And the way it did that was through copying. When I send you an email, I still have the email after I've sent it to you. You don't send an email, that's a metaphor. You copy an email. And that's true of the entire way the internet works. It doesn't send information, it copies information to it. So when I send it, I've still got it. Now, that's a magical communications technology. It means we can send messages at the speed of light. I've got records of everything. It's a near costless communications technology that is magical for sending information and messages. It is incredible for all sorts of things. It is horrible for money. If I've got a money where I give you the money and then I've still got the money, that's a really horrible money. That doesn't work as money. So The internet was incredible as a communications technology, and it was originally built as a communications technology. But the one thing it never had was scarcity. I couldn't send you an email in such a way that I don't have the email anymore. Now you have it. It's trivially easy in the real world. It's almost impossible in the digital world. Blockchain technology was the solution to that problem. It's called the double spending problem. How do I ensure that I can only spend a coin once and not spend it multiple times, which is equivalent to this problem of how do I send you an email in such a way that I don't have it anymore? And then substitute that email for a money, and how do I send you a money in such a way that you've got it and I don't anymore? And everyone can verify that that's true. That's the double spending problem. Cryptocurrencies were the world's first software technology to solve that problem. And for decades, ever since we've had computers and the internet, people have been trying to build digital money. And there's all sorts of ways of doing it. There was sort of this thing called eCash and DigiGold and all sorts of other things.
Let's just back up a sec before we get into the crypto side of it, because I do want to deal with crypto later. What's a blockchain?
A blockchain is a software protocol. So in the same way that the internet is made of software protocols, or HTTP are software protocols, that just enables a group of computers to reach agreement about facts. So it's a blockchain is just a way of a bunch of different computers or nodes all being able to reach agreement about content that they share. Now that's a fairly abstract description of it, but what it means is that my computer, your computer, those other computers, we can all share the same information and trust that it is true. And if I change it, it updates on everyone else's computer. So a blockchain is in this way a shared database or a distributed ledger.
Okay, can I give you an example, and you tell me whether I understand this or not, to try and be a bit analogous of what you're talking about. Currently, if you want to, for example, if you want to look at your Facebook account, it asks you to put in your ID and your password, and that goes to the Facebook server, which is a single server in a single location. And if that single server in the single location had no electricity and it went down, or it was stolen, or someone hacked into it, that would complicate you being able to log into Facebook, because the single server wouldn't recognize or couldn't recognize at that time your ID and your password. But if you had every single Facebook user's computer with your ID and your password, and every time you wanted to log into your Facebook account, every Facebook user would have to agree that your password and your ID was correct, and that would let you have entry. And if someone else tried to hack into the system, there'd be millions of other computers that would disagree. They'd go, no, hang on, that's not right, because we had this other information stored. Where have I gone wrong? Where have I gone right there, Jason?
No, that's pretty good, Russ. I think that description, We can elaborate it a little bit by describing Facebook here as a centralized ledger technology, right? So Facebook is a centralized ledger. A ledger is just a book of information that we need, that everyone has to agree is true, because this is the information that contains my password, my entry conditions, and so on, right? So Facebook is the trusted centralized ledger for that technology, all right? What you described as distributed Facebook, multiple or every user is running their own Facebook protocol. And every time in order for me to log into Facebook, I'm logging into this distributed protocol that everyone is seeing and simultaneously updating if I add a message into it and so on. That sounds horrible in the sense that sounds like from an engineering perspective, that surely we can design a better system than having everyone have to run all the Facebook software and update everything completely, which is true. That would be distributed Facebook, as you described it, would be, from an engineering perspective, the worst possible Facebook. The huge benefit is we don't need Facebook. because we've got this distributed protocol that doesn't actually have the Facebook company. So what you've just invented there was Facebook on the blockchain, which is a distributed protocol that we all upload. I'm sending messages to other people that are running the Facebook protocol. And this is a very complicated and energy and sort of compute intensive Facebook resource. But the huge benefit is there is no centralized data pool that has got all the information and all the login accounts to be attacked. There's no way to attack this Facebook. Secondly, I can't shut this Facebook that you just invented down. And once I put this Facebook, this distributed Facebook up on the internet and people start adopting it and using it, it is just in the world. It can't be killed. If you try and censor it or shut it down, there's no place to do it because all it needs is that one of those nodes still needs to stay alive. So you trade that. This is a trade-off. Centralized Facebook is efficient and fast from a computer and engineering perspective. There's just one database that's controlling everything, which means that if I need to shut it down, I know where to go after. I can go after that node. So centralized Facebook, the one we currently have, is fast, efficient, not very secure because I know how to attack it. I just go after that node, but it can be killed. I can shut it down. The problem is Facebook, as a centralized ledger, has enormous power. It has all your data, it has all mine, it has everyone's data. So we have to trust it. So we have to regulate centralized Facebook, the company. Distributed Facebook is a different animal. From an engineering perspective, it's far more computationally intensive. We're running as many Facebook nodes and protocols as there are users instead of just one. But decentralized Facebook is just like a life force that would just once it was on the web, it's just there. It can't be censored. It can't be shut down. It can't be controlled by any government. It can't be censored. Whether you think of that as that sounds like a horrible thing or that sounds like an amazing thing will depend upon what you're planning to use that for. But what you just described as decentralized Facebook is Bitcoin. But instead of sending messages, social media messages, it's sending money and payments.
And so currently, if we were to have this system of a decentralized, and we're using the example of Facebook, does everybody have the computational power with their laptops and their computers and their phones, the places that they access Facebook, for such a system to exist so that there is no central server to govern the situation? Do we have that capacity at the moment, or is that a new capacity for blockchain to exist within our society that we would need to gain?
Yeah, so it's a really good question, a good technical question that goes to the heart of how blockchains work. So the thing that we didn't emphasize with decentralized Facebook, this metaphor, was how secure is it? How easy is it to attack? Can I just send a message to anyone in this space, or can I send one message and then send another message over the top to overwrite that message? And if we're just sending tweets to each other and cat photos and so on, we don't need much security. I just need to have it time stamped to know when it was sent and for you to be able to identify that it came from me and not someone else. So we can probably get by with fairly low levels of computation in that sense. And when the original Bitcoin blockchain, and the Bitcoin blockchain is the protocol that links all of these networks, these computers together, to enable Bitcoin, the cryptocurrency, to be sent around on the blockchain. When that was first launched back in 2009, you could run it on a laptop. It would run some other things on the back of it. It has a consensus mechanism called proof of work, and proof of work was basically a way just to minimize the amount, or just to ensure that I couldn't spam the system. So in order to update the next block, and we're getting a little bit technical here, a blockchain is just a whole series of ledger accounts that are built on top of each other. So And this is a blockchain is a ledger or a database in a sense, but instead of a database that I overwrite, like an Excel spreadsheet, where if I want to change something, I just overwrite it, or like the way the ledger in a Commonwealth Bank, when you send a transaction, you're updating the Combank ledger, they overwrite it like it's a spreadsheet and that. With a blockchain, that's not how they work. They're way more inefficient than that. To add information to it, you build a new ledger and you just keep state, and that's the chain of blocks. Is this
okay? So let me give you another analogy. A general ledger, in an accounting term, is a system that a company would run where they would use good old-fashioned double-entry bookkeeping, where there's got to be debits and credits, and there's got to be a balance sheet and a trial balance. And that set of accounts within a company is accepted by the tax department as being a self-proving picture of a company's health. And that's kept in the office of the accountant, and the tax department actually don't have a copy of that, but they have a copy of some of the information that comes out of that. Could we say that a distributed ledger was, rather than the accountant having the double entry general ledger in his office that if he got up to mischief, he could change, or if the company chief executive got up to mischief, he could change, and this is running another set of books under the counter. We have that set of accounts, and they're distributed throughout thousands of other, you call them nodes, I just call them computers or whatever that's on people's desk. So all of a sudden, the accountant decides he's going to put his hand in the petty cash tin and a few other places that's reflected in the accounts of the company, in the ledger, the debits and the credits, the trial balance. That information goes out to all of these other nodes or computers everywhere around, and they go, hang on for a moment, this is not right. Doesn't add up. This one company over here has a different set of ledgers than what we have. Is that an exception? An acceptable explanation of a...
Yeah, that's a great explanation. I think the technical term for that is triple entry accounting. Instead of double entry accounting, it's triple entry accounting, distributed accounting. But again, that is the way you described it there is just a series of books where everyone else has a copy of your book and can verify if you've changed your book. Now, again, this triple entry accounting system where everyone can see everyone else's books, again, sounds like the worst possible accounting system, because surely we can design something more efficient, and we can. But to design something more efficient, we have to trust some people. We have to trust the accountants for a start. So we have a profession of that we license, and the job of accountants, as part of the economy, is to provide that, check the books, and enable someone else to verify that those books have been monitored and are true. So one way to do this is to use accountants. To use accountants, we need to have a whole profession. We need to have a legal system. We need to have an education system to provide that. So it's not free. It's a system that works. It was a system that was invented, you know, back in the 14th century, this notion of double entry bookkeeping to do that, the professionalization of this is a thing. So just think of that as the cost of trust, that this provision of, we need someone to monitor the system. We need someone to monitor the monitors. So we need a licensing agency to ensure that accountants are actually what they say they are, and not just someone turning up saying, I will. So there's a cost to doing that, So the idea of, you know, what is blockchain? Blockchain is just another way of doing that. And on some margins, it's worse. We're using a lot of compute resources to do it. We're doubling everything up. We've got accounts. We've got books everywhere now. But if that software consensus mechanism, which is using electricity rather than accountants, if on some margin that is cheaper, then we've got a better system. And this is the argument. It's not the case that, you know, blockchains are a magical new solution. We've already got lots of solutions for money and trust and how we do things. Just the argument here is that on some margins, for some use cases, it's quite expensive to use accountants or banks or other sort of things. Not always. And in many cases, that is exactly how we'll continue to do it. We've got a new technology for doing it that does it, that uses a different architecture. It uses a distributed architecture. We just multiply the books out across the internet. And we have a protocol for updating them. Now, that gives us some new features. It makes it incredibly hard to attack. It gives us some new opportunities and problems. It's now public. I can see what's in those books. Anyone can. I can't tell whose book it is, but I can see what's in the book. I can tell when they've been changed. So the solution of creating trust is actually through radical transparency. A blockchain is radically transparent. Anyone can see anything.
Okay. Let me give you another very specific example, and I'd love you to tell me retrospectively how this problem would have been solved with blockchain. In 1972, the Ford Motor Company produced 300 cars called a Ford XY GT Phase 3 HO. They produced exactly 300. Those cars now are valued between $600,000 and $1 million. Being cars, they have to be registered by state government registration authorities. And if you were to add up the amount of registered Ford Falcon, GT, XY, GDHOs, there's thousands. And that's been authenticated by lots of state government registration authorities. But we actually know they only ever built 300. So obviously, people are up to no good there. How could blockchain, from the moment that car is manufactured off the Ford line to now in 2021, where they're worth a whole lot more money, how could blockchain help that problem? And when would the actual blockchain effect start? Would it be with the migrant worker at the end of the Ford line stamping something on a car that then goes into a register? Physically, how does it work in that example?
Yeah, that's a really interesting use case. So this is a hard one, because what you've described there is something in the physical world, a car that, you know, exists and we can touch it and so on, and the need to establish uniqueness. So I need to know that there was only 300. I need to verify that. Now, as you described, the traditional solution we use for this, not just for cars, but for houses, for stock certificates, for just all assets, is a registry. A registry is a ledger, right? We have to trust who is keeping that registry. There will be a company or a government agency or something, often an insurance company in the case of cars, I'm guessing, that will have a list or a registry. And every time a transaction takes place, a car changes ownership, that registry gets updated. Now, the problem is that the car might be privately sold for cash and the registry might not be updated. And then we come back later and say, actually, it's my car. And, you know, here it is, some photos of it. So there are challenges with updating that registry. But, you know, in principle, the registry system should work. We can have corrupt officials. We can have missing transactions. Someone might have sold it in a different state, and then it comes back again. So the blockchain solution is exactly the same thing. It's still a registry solution, but instead of having a single registry, we have a distributed registry or a distributed ledger. Now, the thing about a distributed ledger is it still has the same problem. We still have to use it. We still have to have all transactions have to go back to it. So some of my colleagues are working on trying to build property rights registries for land and so on, land titling to deal with the same problem. So in principle, if I can attach a token or some sort of digital object to that car, and there's your first problem, I need to bond the Ford XY GT to a single digital token and have that permanently attached to it. So there's your first challenge. If I can, you know, that's like an AirTag on a cow or something like that. I need.
So you're talking about a physical object.
Yep. It'll need to be something that, you know, maybe it's a QR code or something that'll connect the physical object and not be able to be removed. So a lot of blockchain use cases in supply chains are really about providing provenance and tracking of this physical object, but I still need a way to bond the physical object to the digital object, with the digital object as a token. And then I establish ownership of that car or that cow or that bottle of wine or whatever by my possession of the digital object. If I send you the digital object, the token, now it's yours. That's what a Bitcoin is. I'm sending you, but a Bitcoin just doesn't have a physical thing associated with it. It's a pure digital object. So a lot of the first use cases of blockchain technology for establishing what we're describing here is property rights. Property rights through a property register, where if I own the token, if I have the token, that's proof of ownership. The situation that you described was having the ownership, having the token, and being able to connect it to a something in the physical world. That's a harder problem. So a lot of the first use cases for crypto, for blockchain, was just pure native digital only objects, such as a digital money. The next thing was music and creative industry sort of things, which were, you know, music can be music or film or digital art can be represented as pure a digital object as code, as software, as ones and zeros. So anything that is natively digital is actually quite easy to create secure property rights using blockchain technology, which is effectively just saying.
And you say that because it is ones and zeros. And yes. So it's almost like you take the photo, there's the ones and zeros, and that digitally represents either music or a photograph. But if you can't convert it to ones and zeros, which you can't convert a car to ones and zeros, you've got to attach a token.
Well, you've got to make some digital representation of that car. I've got to connect it somehow. So this is why a lot of blockchain technology is effortless and for digitally native things. So anything that comes out of the creative industries, more or less, except sculpture or live theater performance, but music, film, you know, video games, all of those digitally native things are actually quite easy to put into blockchains, precisely because they never touch the physical world. They're digital all the way down.
Recently we've seen artwork sold.
Yeah. NFTs.
And so that's easy because what you're saying is you take a photo of it. The photo is a whole lot of digital.
No, it's not a photo of it. It is the artwork. The artwork is the ones and zeros.
So how do we have the Mona Lisa, which is painted, yep. That's not ones and zeros.
No, that's a physical object. I need to, okay. And yep.
The Economist.
A video game, for instance, okay, or digital art.
The ones and zeros. Yep. The Economist magazine recently sold their cover as a non-fungible token.
Non-fungible. Let me explain that. Right. This is an important point. So this podcast is something that we could tokenize because it's just ones and zeros. I'm speaking into this microphone. This microphone is converting my my voice into a digital signal, yours as well. It's digital all the way down. So we could turn this into one. NFTs or non-fungible tokens. It's a bit of a term of art, but money is a fungible token. So an Australian dollar is a fungible token in the sense that one Australian dollar is fungible for any other Australian dollar. If I give you an Australian dollar and I ask for it back, I don't care whether I get the exact one I gave you back. Just give me any Australian dollar. It's fungible, right? So cryptocurrencies such as Bitcoin and Ethereum are fungible in the sense that any one of them can be exchanged for any one of them. They're all the same. Many things in the economy aren't fungible. Houses aren't fungible. I can't give you a house and just say, give me back any house. I need that house back. I give you an artwork and you don't give me back any artwork. I need that particular artwork. So most things in the economy are non-fungible in the sense that they're specific, just that one. A non-fungible token is a digital object, a scarce digital object that points to just that thing. So when I've got my token for the Mona Lisa, it's not just a token for any artwork. It's this, whoever holds this token is connected to that Mona Lisa and only that one, this token is non-fungible. The broader way to think about that is that this is non-fungible tokens are digital property rights.
That's where we'll leave part one. In part two of the Bergenomics podcast on blockchain and cryptocurrency, I ask Professor Potts how cryptocurrencies are created, and we discuss the skepticism surrounding cryptocurrencies.